Part 1. Case Facts. Capture. Between November 1989 and November 1990, the police discovered the bodies of six men who had all been murdered in the same way. Shot, seemingly robbed, and left in the dust of their stolen car in most cases. While a seventh victim's body was never found, the crime scene was the same, with the addition of a smudgy palm print on the interior of the abandoned car, and a few strands of blonde hair on the seat. There was clearly a pattern, and suspicion grew that the murders were committed by a serial killer in the area. All victims were white, middle-aged men from low- to middle-income backgrounds who were traveling alone on the highways in Florida. Never had it entered the investigators' minds that the murders were committed by one woman by herself. At that point, they were toying with the idea of a killer couple, a female accomplice of a male serial killer, or a variety of crimes committed by various people that just seemed to fit a pattern. That is, until they scanned the palm print and fingerprints found in the car, which brought up the picture of a female with a criminal history, Miss Eileen Carol Lee Wuornos, a 5'4", 162 cm, 137 lb, 62 kg woman, who had frequent run-ins with the law in the years leading up to these crimes. She had previously been arrested for driving under the influence, DUIs, disorderly conduct, armed robbery, forgery, theft, resisting arrest, and firing a .22-caliber pistol from a moving vehicle. The victims were all murdered with a .22-caliber pistol at point-blank range, and their belongings were stolen and pawned off in the area. A search for some of the items resulted in the link that police needed to arrest her. The receipt for the items from victim Richard Mallory that she had sold still had her thumbprint on it, which matched the prints found at the crime scene and directly tied her to the murder. She had used several aliases, including Susan Lynn Blahovec, Cammy Marsh Green, and Lori Christine Grody. Witnesses who had spotted two women driving, crashing, and abandoning a 1988 Pontiac Sunbird were able to offer the police a physical description of them, one of whom matched the mugshots they had of Eileen Wuornos. Instead of locating and arresting her immediately, they decided to release composite sketches of their suspects and observe their every move. Would they be arresting one or two women involved in these murders? Florida newspapers and the national media released the following details. Two women are being sought as possible suspects in the shooting deaths of 8 to 12 middle-aged men who were lured to their deaths on the Florida highways. Suspect number one is a white female, 5'8 to 5'10 with blonde hair, who is 20 to 30 years old. She may have a heart tattoo on her upper arm. Suspect number two is also a white female, 5'4 to 5'6 with a heavy build and short brown hair. She may be wearing a baseball cap. These women are armed and dangerous and may be our nation's first female serial killers. Investigators feel compelled to warn the public, particularly middle-aged white men traveling alone. When this information was released to the public, up to 15 Hollywood movie companies were already competing for the rights to the killer's story. Tyria Moore was aware of at least the first murder that Eileen had committed and started fearing for her own future, leaving town to move in with her sister in Pennsylvania. Eileen lay low at the Fairview Inn, a motel in Port Orange, Florida, where they had been staying in room number 9, now room number 7, for several months, making sure to get rid of any evidence that could tie her to the murders. She threw her gun into Rose Bay, which was in proximity to the motel, and stored her belongings, along with the items stolen from her victims, in a storage unit at Daytona Beach. Half a mile from the motel, a 7-minute walk, was a biker bar called The Last Resort Bar, which was a dark, dingy, and tacky hangout spot for local biker clubs, the perfect spot for Eileen to drown her sorrows in as many beers as she could get her hands on, shoot some pool, and maybe even continue to hustle for a living. This is where two undercover cops would sit and watch her for hours over a period of 3 days and 2 nights. They needed to see her in her natural state to properly understand what could have caused her to murder so many men in 1 year and why. One of the undercover cops was Mike Joyner, who went by the name Buckethead at the bar to blend in with the crowd. He watched as she mingled with the crowd, howled and sang along to songs beaming out of the jukebox, her favorite being Digging Up Bones by Randy Travis, and sucked cigarettes as she propositioned some of the men in the bar. Most of them knew that she was a lesbian and laughed off her efforts to entice them. Joyner said, "The only way to get close to someone that dangerous and vindictive is money. And every time I took money out of my pocket, I let her see the $100 bills. I started buying her beer and cigarettes and playing pool." Slowly but surely, Joyner befriended Eileen and let her think that he was interested in her services. By closing time on January the 8th, she was completely intoxicated and looked more weathered than her 34 years of life could account for. She stumbled outside and curled up on a brown leather chair on the front porch and fell asleep. In their small conversations, Joyner said that Eileen had told him how sad and lonely she had been since her girlfriend had moved back up north after they broke up. He listened to her, bought her beer and food, and played some pool with her and said, "I think it was the second day that we were together. I was shooting pool and she hit me on the back with a pool stick and broke the pool stick. I looked up at her and said, 'Why in the world would you do that?' And her exact words were, 'Honey, I don't know. Sometimes it just comes over me.'" This demonstrates how impulsive Eileen's rage sometimes was. Whether she had no control over it or just wanted to beat and rob him is anyone's guess. On January 9th, 1989, the two cops returned to the bar knowing that they were going to arrest her on an outstanding warrant for a concealed weapon charge under her alias Lori Grody. Joyner was convinced that she had chosen him as her next victim and decided that it was time for her to be put behind bars. She sat at the bar sipping the last icy cold Budweiser that she would ever have, and when she spotted Joyner, was happy to see him and told him to get all his money because she was going to show him a really good time. He told her that he would go and arrange the motel room for the night, which he did, returning with a room key. When she spotted the key, she knew it was go time, so she gathered her things and enthusiastically followed him out of the bar. Two sheriffs were waiting outside for her with handcuffs, which got her all fired up for confrontation and defiance. Investigator Larry Horzepa told her that she was under arrest for a previous concealed weapon charge for Lori Grody, one of the many aliases she had used in the past. She was guided into the police vehicle and driven to Volusia County Jail, 16 miles, 25 kilometers from the bar, and all of her belongings were confiscated, including the key that she had told Joyner was the key to her whole life. On January 10th, 1991, the police were able to track down her lover and possible accomplice, Tyria Moore, in Scranton, Pennsylvania, where she was staying with her sister. They convinced her to return to Florida to avoid being prosecuted as an accomplice to the crimes. When she returned, she was offered immunity from prosecution in exchange for getting Eileen to confess to the crimes and for telling the police everything that she knew. She agreed and was put up in a motel where she was given plenty of burgers and beers and guided in 10 phone calls made to Eileen in prison to get her to confess. Eileen was cautious at first and frequently asked her if they were being monitored or if anyone was in the room with her. Eventually, Tyria had to threaten to take her own life and feign some croaky tears to push Eileen to confess. "If I have to confess everything to keep you from getting in trouble, I will, okay?" Eileen said. She loved her dearly and would have done anything to protect her, even if it meant sacrificing her own life and sanity for her. "Then do it now. Do it right now and get it over with," Tyria urged. And on January 16th, 1991, Eileen confessed to the murders of 7 men, but making sure that they understood that it was self-defense and that her girlfriend had nothing to do with it. Detectives Bruce Munster and Larry Horzepa had to remind Eileen that they were cops and not attorneys and that she had the right to remain silent, but she was set on confessing to ensure that Tyria was kept out of trouble. In the meantime, the police had traced the key to the storage unit at Jack's mini warehouses at Daytona Beach, where they found more than 50 items that were missing from the murder victims, including unique rings, watches, flashlights, a briefcase, and crowbars. Those belonging to Richard Mallory, her first victim, confirmed her arrest for first-degree murder on January 17th, 1991. Once her case had become a media frenzy, the Last Resort Bar transformed itself into an Eileen Wuornos shrine, famous for being the location of her arrest and the last place that she ever sipped brewski with the boys. They printed t-shirts of her face, created a hot sauce called Crazed Killer Hot Sauce, with her execution date on it, and a warning. This hot sauce could drive you insane, or at least off on some murderous rampage. Eileen liked it, and look what it did to her. A list of her victims' names, a framed picture of her, and had her name painted on the bricks on the bar's exterior wall. They rebranded with the slogan, Home of Ice Cold Beer and Killer Woman, later adding, where the movie Monster was filmed, and have attracted true crime enthusiasts and curious travelers for more than 3 decades. Visitors usually also book a night at the motel, which is now called the Scoot Inn, previously the Fairview Inn, and ask to stay in Eileen's room. According to the owner, most people just want to visit for a few hours to take photographs of the room, oddly, especially the bathroom, where they imagined she washed herself off after murdering a man. The Last Resort bar owner, Al Bulling, said, "She wanted to be remembered and keep the memory going. Well, we'll keep it going for her." However, letters between Eileen and her friend Dawn Botkins expressed her disappointment in being exploited by the bar, especially because she had been there less than half a dozen times in her life. They barely knew her or spoke to her and mostly created stories about her to build a business. The bar was featured in several scenes of the movie based on Eileen's life and crimes, Monster, 2003, which starred Charlize Theron, who won an Academy Award and Golden Globe Award for Best Actress. During the filming of the movie, Theron autographed the ceiling and a poster, which became the bar's most prized possession and transformed it into the more approachable place that it is today. "I have not had one woman in here yet, I don't care if they were 9 or 90, that said she got what she deserved. Every woman felt sorry for her in one way or another," Bulling said. The bartender, known only as Cannonball, who claimed to know Eileen the best, said, "I've been asked some of the stupidest questions. Did she act like a serial killer? Well, hell, I don't know. I've never seen one. I don't know what they act like. And one guy asked me, well, were you scared of her? I had never been scared of nobody. When they first come in, she goes, my name is Lee, and this is my girlfriend Ty, and we're gay. And I'm, well, my name's Cannonball, and I don't care. Pay for what you get, don't cause me no grief, and I'll treat you square. I don't care what anybody is." They are open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 2 a.m. If you are ever in the area and want to visit, the address is 5812 South Ridgewood Avenue, Port Orange, Florida. And the Scoot Inn is at 5964 South Ridgewood Avenue, Port Orange, Florida. Disclaimer, enter at your own risk. Trial and sentencing. On January 14th, 1992, 1 year after confessing to the murders of 7 men, Eileen Wuornos went to trial in Deland, Volusia County, Florida, for the murder of 51-year-old Richard Mallory, her first victim, whose body, car, personal belongings, including a camera and radar detector, and murder weapon had been traced directly to her. She was represented by the Chief Assistant Public Defender of the 5th Judicial Circuit, Tricia Jenkins, and the Assistant Public Defender, Billy Nolis. John Tanner was the state's attorney, and the judge was Uriel Bunky Blount Jr., who came out of retirement to try her case when another judge had been disqualified from it. He had a career that lasted more than 5 decades and had experience in sentencing prolific criminals, including the death sentence of Daniel Morris Thomas, the leader of the Ski Mask Bandits, and Arnold Flicker, the leader of a group who had murdered a 77-year-old widow. Usually, prosecutors cannot use a defendant's previous criminal records, patterns, or behaviors as evidence in a trial, but Florida's Williams Rule allows this in certain cases. If it is used to demonstrate motive, intent, modus operandi, knowledge, or lack of a mistake, and not abused to prove bad character, the judge may allow it. In Eileen's case, Judge Blount accepted the use of the Williams Rule, which meant that her past, including the 6 additional murders that she would be on trial for, could all be brought up as evidence in court. The odds were stacked against her from the start. Prosecutors based most of their case on Wuornos's 4-hour videotaped confession to investigator Lawrence Horzepa during her initial interrogation on January 16, 1991, at Volusia County Jail, which the defense failed to convince Circuit Judge Gail Graziano not to release because it would damage the chances of a fair trial for Eileen, something that the prosecution took full advantage of. It helped to demonstrate the inconsistencies in her story, as well as the initial lack of descriptions of rape, malice, or violence of any kind from her victim, Richard Mallory. Unfortunately, at the time, Eileen was completely consumed with protecting her lover of 5 years, Tyria Moore, and based her entire confession on ensuring that she would not be incriminated as an accomplice in any of the crimes. The defense argued that Wuornos's relationship with Moore had been exploited to get an involuntary videotaped confession out of her, which violated her rights to due process, even though they acknowledged that she had been read her Miranda rights and had legal advice from a public defender. It was said that Moore's ability to put Wuornos in an emotionally vulnerable state caused her to say anything that would help to keep her partner free from culpability in the crimes, which also affected her understanding of her rights or the consequences that she was facing. Even though her lawyer insisted that she say as little as possible to the police, she kept insisting, "I took a life, I'm willing to give up my life because I killed people. I deserve to die." She also said, "I am a very kind person, but when I get drunk, I do stupid things. And if you're a hooker and you get somebody who starts messing with you, then you get angry." The defense filed a motion to suppress the confession from being used in court, but of course at that point, it was too late. The media already had their hands on it and were creating a valuable and exciting reputation for Eileen in the public eye. Throughout the trial, Eileen was dressed neatly and did her best to look presentable with jailhouse resources. When she took the stand, she wore a blue blazer, white collared shirt, floral skirt, and gold necklace. First, she was questioned about her background, how she ended up in Florida, and her relationship with Tyria. Later, she detailed the violent sexual assault and life-threatening circumstances that she found herself in with her victim, Richard Mallory. This was perceived as an inconsistency based on her leaving this information out when she confessed to the police in the videotape. While Mallory was known as a troubled eccentric whose electronics repair shop business was steeped in debt, which implied that he would not have afforded to pay for sexual favors at the time, the defense failed to source and present critical information about him, which they were heavily criticized for post-trial. He was a sex offender who had been sentenced to 10 years in prison for the assault and attempted rape of a woman in Maryland in 1957. He had also paid for sex with a Tampa area woman, Chastity Marcus, who was initially the primary suspect in his murder, by rewarding her with a 19-inch color television and video cassette recorder on the same night that he had disappeared. Sadly, as grave an injustice as this was against Eileen's right to a fair trial, this was not the defense's only failure. They also failed to obtain reliable witnesses who had known Eileen throughout her life and could have presented valuable information in court simply by not rescheduling any meetings, answering calls, or making the necessary arrangements to have them there. Her friends were aware of the incestuous abuse that Eileen was subjected to from her uncle and stepbrother, Barry Wuornos, and alcoholic grandfather, Laurie Wuornos, and prosecutors capitalized on the defense's failure to have those witnesses on the stand, instead getting Barry and his sister Laurie to tell the world how normal her childhood had been. Had reliable witnesses been there to testify in Eileen's defense, including friends and her regular clients, the likelihood of her getting sentenced to life instead of death was extremely high. Instead, she had to defend herself and make use of her Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination 25 times to complete her story relating to the murder of Richard Mallory. Prosecutors cunningly convinced the jury that Mallory had no previous criminal record, even adding, For 20 years, he led a normal, uneventful life. What happened that far back is irrelevant. While applying William's rule to use as much evidence as possible from Eileen's past to build their case against her and debunk her claims of self-defense. Prosecutors also had Tahria Moore on their side, who threw Eileen under the bus without hesitation to protect her own freedom, which was devastating to watch. She answered all of the questions presented to her as best she could, but smirked, known in body language references as duping delight, as she told the court about the conversation that she had with Eileen regarding Mallory's death. "We were sitting on the floor watching TV, and she just came out and said, 'I have something to tell you,' and I asked her what, and she said that she had shot and killed a man that day." The prosecutor asked, "Did you say anything when she told you?" She answered, "No, I didn't want to believe it. I was probably in awe." Perhaps she meant in shock or disbelief, but there is a possibility that she meant exactly what she said. Perhaps she had admired Eileen for her crimes, but needed to save herself from the consequences of it. Tahria did not look at Eileen throughout her testimony, distancing herself completely to maintain her stone-cold face during the questioning. Eileen was heartbroken and cried in her hands as prosecutors played the recordings of the phone calls that had convinced her to confess. She had been through the worst in life, but had never felt so betrayed. Not only did Tahria sell her out in court, which sealed her fate, but she was later also exposed for signing rights to movies and books with a band of corrupt police officers. On January 27, 1992, after just 2 hours of deliberation, the jury found Eileen Wuornos guilty of all charges, including armed robbery. On January 28, 1992, the trial entered its penalty phase with the same jury, who would decide between life and death as punishment for the murder of Richard Mallory. Psychiatrists and psychologists presented their case to the jury, unanimous in their diagnosis of Eileen having borderline personality disorder. The state's expert psychologist, Dr. Bernard, testified that Wuornos suffered from borderline personality disorder, BPD, and antisocial personality disorder, ASPD, but that her impairment was not substantial and her disturbance was not extreme, even though she may have experienced mental deterioration at the time of her crimes. He also expressed that her alcoholism, upbringing, genetic and environmental deficits, and mental challenges, including an IQ of 81, provided non-statutory mitigating evidence. Three defense psychologists testified that Eileen suffered from borderline personality disorder and would have gone through extreme emotional and psychological disturbance at the time of her crimes. One psychologist said that the details of her story shifting and changing was not her intentionally lying, but a symptom of her mental illness. Her childhood was summarized as traumatic, and her life was portrayed as being the victim of extreme violence, betrayal, and abuse, which may have resulted in her lashing out at one of her victimizers, Richard Mallory. When Eileen's IQ and maturity were brought up by psychologists, she giggled, which her defense attorneys used as evidence of her distorted and immature view of the world. Jenkins said that Eileen was a damaged and primitive child who should not be put to death for her crimes, but rather be sentenced to life behind bars. The jury considered all aggravating factors, which included a previous criminal record based on violence, the robbery of her victim, murder to avoid arrest, murder that was particularly cruel, cold, and premeditated, as well as the one mitigating factor that she was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. Her childhood, physical abuse, the fact that her father and grandfather committed suicide, her incestuous relationship with her brother, who died in 1976 at the age of 21, her grandmother's death from the consequences of alcoholism, her teenage pregnancy, and her mother abandoning her at a young age were all taken into consideration. The jury unanimously concluded in a vote of 12-0 that despite all these difficulties, Eileen still knew right from wrong at the time of her crimes and should be sentenced to death. Before she was sentenced, Arlene Prawley, a woman who had decided to legally adopt her on November 6, 1991, made a statement where she pleaded for mercy for her daughter's life, saying that she never had a chance to receive the treatment that she had always needed for her disorder, something that she offered to pay for if they spared her life. Eileen, dressed neatly in a pink turtleneck with a gold necklace and her hands clasped together, was allowed the opportunity to make a brief comment to the judge. She said, "First of all, I'd like to say that I've been labeled a serial killer, and I am no serial killer. I have been framed by law enforcement as a serial killer because of numerous men involved. But what I was a prostitute, and in my prostitution, I happened to deal with a lot of men, at least 250 a month, and I ran into these men along the way in my prostitution. I do not feel I was not out there to hurt anyone. I had no intentions of hurting anyone. In my confessions, I stated that I stated 37 times self-defense, 39 times that they raped or beat and then began to rape and had intentions of killing, and what I did is what anyone else would do. I defended myself, which everybody has the right to defend themselves. And I had no intentions of killing anyone. I would not do that. I am not that type of person." Anyway, what I'm trying to say here is that while I've been through these 2.5 weeks in the courtroom, I told you that I was raped and that is what happened. And that is what happened with all the other cases that I'll be involved in and discussing. And these people did a violent attack on me. And I did what I had to do to protect myself. Now, I'd like to point out one other thing is that law enforcement has framed me as a serial killer purposely for books and movies. On January 31st, 1992, Judge Blount Jr. sentenced Eileen to 10 years for the armed robbery charges plus death by electrocution for the premeditated first-degree murder of Richard Mallory. He said, "By warrant of the governor of the state of Florida, you, Eileen Carol Wuornos, be electrocuted until you are dead. May God have mercy on your corpse." It was a harsh ending to a grim trial, and usually one would say, "Have mercy on your soul," not your corpse. The judge's feelings towards her were clear. When she was escorted out of the Florida Supreme Courtroom and into a van to be transferred to death row, she yelled out to the media, "Bust these crooked cops and their conspiracy, please. I'm innocent." She looked defeated, traumatized, and lost, which was unlike her usual hair-tossing, finger-flipping self. Death row. After the trial, Eileen was driven to the Florida Department of Corrections, Broward Correctional Institution, BCI, a maximum security death row facility for women approximately 471 miles, 762 kilometers away. Out of the 160 inmates that had been executed since the U.S. Supreme Court had reinstated the death penalty in 1976, only one had been a woman, which was Velma Barfield in North Carolina. When Eileen got to BCI, she would cross paths with Judas Judy Bonono, who was also incarcerated there for murdering her husband, son, and the attempted murder of her boyfriend. She was executed on March 30, 1998, in the electric chair and was the first woman to be executed in Florida since 1848. Eileen would be the second. Once Eileen had settled into her cell, she felt compelled to fire her public defender, Tricia Jenkins, and seek new representation based on how poorly her defense had represented her in her first trial. She would face several more trials for the murders of 5 other men, so she needed a team that would have her best interests at heart. Arlene Prawley, her adoptive mother, stepped right up and suggested her friend, Stephen Glazer, a former musician and marijuana-smoking newbie attorney, who would help her come clean. She even offered to pay for all of his services, and together, her and Steve convinced Eileen that it was best for her to expedite her death and ask the court for forgiveness in her next trial, hoping for some sort of miracle to happen. Arlene said that she could live with her on her farm where she was breeding horses and wolves, and that Eileen could look forward to a new life with her, her husband, and evidently their friend Steve. As they were preparing for her next trial, news broke of Tyria's involvement with the police in movie deals based on Eileen's story, which Eileen had tried to warn the judge about. Captain Jarvis, one of the whistleblowers, had his home burgled and found threatening notes on his doorstep which said, "Keep your mouth shut if you want to keep your family. No jokes. Fact. The only items that were stolen out of his home were Eileen's case files, which was no surprise to him based on the corruption that he had stumbled on. The Florida Police Department refused to investigate the burglary and implied that Jarvis had created the scene himself for media exposure. Jarvis resigned and became a private investigator in Tampa, Florida, exposing some of the details of the corruption in media interviews, including in the documentary Eileen Wuornos, The Selling of a Serial Killer by Nick Brimfield. He said that he had realized that the state had a set outcome in mind for Eileen and had no intention of implicating Tyria Moore in the crimes, even though she was found in possession of items belonging to some of the murder victims. Tyria had also been the one driving one of the victims' cars that they had crashed and abandoned, which is how the composite sketches of a female killer duo came about. The police, who were exposed for their corruption, suffered minor consequences, none of which benefited or avenged Eileen. Major Dan Henry resigned, and Captain Binniger and Sergeant Munster were transferred out of the Criminal Investigation Division. Because of the increased media hype surrounding the moving parts of Eileen's case, Arlene and Steve realized that they had underestimated the value of having direct contact with her. They started advertising her letters, poetry, and personal belongings as items that the press could see, touch, and capture, and put a price tag on any interviews with them, which was upward of $10,000 per interview. When Nick Brimfield, a documentary film producer, approached them, they proposed a fee of $25,000 for an interview with them, where they would tell the story of how they met Eileen and possibly even get him an in-person interview with her. When Brimfield asked how the money would be split, Arlene said that he should give her all of the money as her mom and that Steve would get a percentage of that as her attorney and agent. While they did not mention the percentage that Eileen would get, they insisted that she was the one who was setting the prices for their media interviews. The son of Sam Law once prevented inmates from benefiting financially from their work behind bars, but at the time, it was no longer applied in most states, but was and is still in effect in New York. Steve said that he hoped to capture video footage of Eileen's execution in the electric chair, anticipating that she would welcome the idea of having him as her attorney right by her side as she died, which he knew would have a high value. Brimfield did a great job of exposing their antics on camera. His documentary was even used in court at Eileen's final appeal hearing as evidence of the corruption surrounding her case. Eileen had little to rely on and, at the time, had trusted Arlene with her life. She hired Steve and on March 31, 1991, named him as her new attorney. Within minutes, he was standing in front of Judge Thomas Sawyer to file a motion for her no-contest plea to any further murder charges, which shocked everyone. A no-contest plea was equivalent to a guilty plea in court, which meant that she was accepting the maximum consequences for the murders of Charles Humphreys and Troy Burress from Marion County and David Spears from Citrus County. Judge Sawyer tried to explain to Eileen that because there was no plea deal, she would be facing capital punishment in each additional case. She stood next to Steve, clasping her hands in front of her hair brushed as best as it could be, and let him do the talking. He insisted that her intentions were to come clean and get right with God, and that she wanted to die for what she had done. Arlene was also present in court, and watched eagerly as Steve paraphrased out of the Bible to secure Eileen's date with death. In an interview, when asked how she felt about her daughter's sentencing, she said, "Well, God has forgiven her for what she's done, and our state has a death penalty, so why not go for it? I mean, wow, she could be home with Jesus in a matter of a few years." She looked genuinely enthusiastic about this, believing that she was facilitating a future that Eileen could look forward to, even saying that she wished it were her time to go too. In letters to her, Arlene had been instructing her how to seek forgiveness and how to behave more appropriately in court, which influenced her to believe that an angelic approach would give her the justice that she believed she deserved throughout her life. On May 15, 1992, she meekly read a statement that she had prepared for weeks in her cell. "I have made peace with my Lord, and I have asked for forgiveness. I'm sorry that my acts of self-defense ended up in court like this, but I take full responsibility for my actions. It was them or me. I am sorry for all the pain that my actions have caused. I am prepared to die if you say it is necessary. She had been used to getting what she wanted when she had set her mind to something. But this time, she wasn't dealing with biker boys and bar hoppers. She was facing the logic of the law. Judge Swayer calmly read her sentencing. 3 additional death sentences, 1 for each murder charge that she was on trial for at the time. Eileen's little girl mannerisms dissolved, her face tensed in disbelief, and within seconds she became enraged, saying, "Thank you. I'll be in heaven while you all rot in hell." She then looked directly at the assistant state attorney, Rick Ridgway, with her widened, terrorizing eyes and said, "May your wife and kids get raped, right in the ass." Right before she stood up and stormed out of the courtroom, middle finger in the air, screaming, "I know I was raped. You ain't nothing but a bunch of scum. Putting someone who was raped to death, fucking motherfucker." Once Eileen got back to her cell in BCI, she sank into a deep depression and refused to talk to anyone. Arlene wrote her letters, scolding her for her behavior in court, and reminded her that Steve had done nothing wrong. But Eileen had realized that the little plan that Arlene and Steve had concocted had failed, that there were no miracles, and that they had predominantly been involved with her for financial gain. She missed Tyria and tried to reach out to her, but ultimately she knew that she had lost the battle and just wanted to be put out of her misery. In some of the post-trial interviews with Nick Broomfield, Steve admitted that he did not have the resources or experience to handle a capital punishment case, which is why he was happy that Eileen had pleaded no contest. Trisha Jenkins exposed the fact that Steve had not even picked up Eileen's case files in preparation for the trial, and that he had told her that he was only taking on the case because he needed the media exposure. And of course, he did. He had only graduated from law school 2 years prior to this trial and wanted to add it to his resume to attract clients. When Nick eventually managed to sit down with Eileen for an interview, which she had previously resisted based on her skepticism towards Steve and Eileen, she told him that they had been giving her suggestions for how to take her own life in prison, and that she had come to realize that their main mission was to see her die. She said, "Arlene did not adopt me to be my mother. She adopted me to bury me, and she adopted me just to visit and have easier access to visitation." The problem was, she had snookered herself by listening to their advice, and had decided that getting executed as fast as possible would be her goal going forward. From that moment on, she dropped the self-defense claims and started portraying herself as a cold-blooded killer who was thirsty for more. When Nick had confronted Arlene and called her out for being a deceptive mercenary, she wrote Eileen a letter to tell her that she should be careful of him because she didn't trust his eyes. But Eileen's trust in anyone had already been obliterated, so her communication with anyone became about what she could gain out of it. For example, she kept in contact with Nick over the years because she believed that he had the power to spread the awareness of the crooked cops who had made her into a serial killer for books and movies. In May 1992, the penalty trial for the murder of Charles Carskadden, a Pasco County victim, was waived, and in June, Eileen pled guilty again, receiving her 5th death sentence by November. Shocking information was discovered about Richard Mallory's past, which included a criminal record for sexual assault, but the judge would not allow this information to be presented in court and would not entertain the thought of a retrial. Jack Kasowitz, NBC's private investigator, had discovered some of the information and knew that, if presented as evidence, it would change the outcome of Eileen's sentences from death to life. When the judge disallowed any of it, Dateline NBC aired an episode on November 10th, 1992, presented by Michelle Gillen, which exposed it to the public. In February 1993, Eileen pleaded guilty to the murder of Walter Antonio, receiving her 6th and final death sentence in a jury vote of 7-5. The body of her 7th victim, Peter Siems, was never found, so she could not be formally charged or sentenced for his murder. On November 17th, 1992, the movie based on her life and crimes, Overkill, was released in the USA, which fueled Eileen's belief that the cops had framed her into becoming a serial killer for financial gain. Movies, books, documentaries, and talk shows were created about her, just as she had anticipated, with Arlene Parley at the front line taking as much as a 33% cut in some of the deals, including Dolores Kennedy's book, On a Killing Day. In court, Eileen expressed her thoughts about the movie that had been released about her. "They've tried to vile my character and make me look like a monster, like I'm deranged or something like a Jeffrey Dahmer, which I'm not. I intend to expose the crooked cops to the people all over the world." She also said, "The movie Overkill is a total fictional lie, and they framed me as a first-time female serial killer for the title for that movie. The first female serial killer is not what I am. I'm not even near it, and my confessions prove it. Yet they've taken my confession and went 200% against what my confession stated to get their bogus movie out." Her automatic direct appeal, according to the state constitution of Florida, was handled by Assistant Public Defender Christopher S. Carls, and on November 16, 1994, the Supreme Court of Florida affirmed her conviction and sentence. She filed a petition for a review of her sentence, known as a writ of certiorari in the U.S., based on the new information about Mallory, but it was denied on April 17, 1995. During the post-conviction proceedings leading up to her execution, Eileen fired several attorneys and by 2001 decided to drop all her appeals. Some attorneys approached the Florida Supreme Court to raise concerns over her deteriorating mental health, which was largely ignored. Eileen was also writing lengthy motions of up to 25 pages to the court to describe the abuse she was suffering at the hands of prison staff. It was evident that over time, her mental health had deteriorated so significantly that she was suffering from psychosis and paranoia, believing that her food was being poisoned, her mind was being controlled, that everyone wanted her dead, and that her case was a conspiracy that needed to be exposed. The state and federal appellate courts evaluated and rejected her claims. By 2001, Eileen's only chance of survival was in the hands of Governor Jeb Bush, who had the power to grant her clemency with the approval of two clemency board members, even though she had no will to survive. In a petition to the Florida Supreme Court, she said, "I killed those men. I robbed them as cold as ice. And I'd do it again, too. I have hate crawling through my system. I am so sick of hearing this she's crazy stuff. I've been evaluated so many times. I'm competent, sane, and I'm trying to tell the truth. I'm one who seriously hates human life and I would kill again." Even though the Supreme Court had ruled in 1989 that it is not unconstitutional to execute a mentally impaired inmate, they need to be found competent to understand, number one, why they have been sentenced to death, and number two, that execution means that they will die. Her final attorney, Raag Singhal, wrote letters to Jeb Bush to raise grave doubts of her mental state, and on September 30, 2002, a stay of execution was granted and a mental evaluation was ordered. Within 15 minutes, three state-ordered psychiatrists had decided that Wuornos was competent to be executed, which lifted the stay and confirmed October 9, 2002, as her execution date. Eileen fired Singhal, livid that he would try to sabotage her execution. She had expressed relief that the state of Florida had abolished the electric chair and was even more ready to be executed than when she was initially sentenced to death. To the media, Bush said, "I did it because I believe in the death penalty and I have a duty to implement with the law." Florida Support and Ohio Group filed a motion on her behalf to stay the execution based on her extreme mental illness, but this motion was also denied. Eileen had declined the opportunity for a mass media press conference before being executed, requesting to be interviewed exclusively by Nick Broomfield to make her final statements. She still believed that he was the best person to relay her message to the world, and perhaps he was. Throughout the years of conversations with her, Nika tried to understand whether she had committed the murders in self-defense or whether she truly was just a cold-blooded killer. In 1992, when she thought that the cameras were no longer rolling, she whispered to him that it had all been done in self-defense, but that she needed to stop saying that to get executed faster. "I can't tell anybody. Never. I have to go down to the execution. They were too corrupt," she said. His final interview with her took place on October 8, 2002, the day before her execution, where her main goal was still to expose the crooked cops and their agenda. When asked how she believed her life would have turned out if she had grown up in a safe and loving home, she said, "I would have become more than likely an outstanding citizen of America who would have either been an archaeologist, a paramedic, a police officer, a fire department gal, or an undercover worker for the DEA, or a missionary." She detailed her death row routine, which was to isolate herself in her cell, write letters to her friend, Dawn Botkins, read the Bible, and get all her tears out so that she wouldn't be seen crying in the execution chamber. She had stopped smoking, refused to go outside to mingle with any other inmates, and just sat waiting for her execution day to arrive. "I'm okay. God is going to be there, Jesus Christ is going to be there, all the angels and everything. And whatever's on the beyond, I think it's going to be more like Star Trek, beaming me up into a space vehicle, man. Then I move on and recolonize to another planet or whatever. But whatever's at beyond, I know it's going to be good because I didn't do anything as wrong as they said. I did the right thing, and I saved a lot of people's butts from getting hurt and raped and killed too." Her mind drifted off to the wrongs that had been done against her, including the use of sonic pressure on her head since 1997, mind control, letting her kill to create a female serial killer for books and movies, and having to wash her food off to avoid being killed off by the prison staff at BCI. Her mental health had deteriorated so much that Nick Broomfield was genuinely concerned and not sure how to proceed with the interview. He asked her one last time whether she had committed the murders in cold blood or self-defense, which enraged her and terminated the interview. "I'm leaving. I'm glad. Thanks a lot, society, for railroading my ass," she said. She was furious that she was paying for her crimes with her life, believing that the state was sending a raped woman to the execution chamber and that everyone had only been using and abusing her for money. If she had passed the mental health test to prove her competence before being executed, what would it have taken to fail it? "She's obsessed and crazed, has totally lost her mind. She trusts nobody and is stark raving mad. She's multiple people. Every time I met her, she was a different person," Broomfield said. The documentary, Eileen, Life and Death of a Serial Killer, 2003, captured her final moments on camera before she was executed, an opportunity that she had only given to him. Steve did not, in the end, get any access to her as he had hoped. Execution. 46-year-old Eileen had spent a decade on death row and said that she was prepared and ready to go when her execution day arrived. She was transferred from BCI to the Florida State Prison, a 366-mile, 589-kilometer journey north where a small media crowd had started to gather, ready to cover her execution. On the evening of October 8, 2002, she was given a $20 budget for a special meal from the prison canteen, which she declined. In Broomfield's documentary, he mentioned that she had shared a meal of KFC and French fries with her friend, Dawn Botkins, while some reports say that she opted for a hamburger and snacks from the canteen. In an interview, Dawn confirmed that none of that was true. She brought Eileen what she wanted into the prison, which was 2 calzones, potato chips, and soda, an order limited to a $20 budget, and they shared that for her final meal. Dawn left at midnight, saying that there were no tears shed because they had both been preparing for her death for years through their letters. She said that they had prayed together for Eileen's forgiveness from the families of the men that she had murdered. At 12:30, she consumed 1 cup of black coffee, which was the last thing she had and is often reported as her final meal. The next day, Dawn was able to pass on a message from Eileen to Broomfield to say that she was not upset with him, but that she had to cut the interview short to avoid anything jeopardizing her execution. She had also given society and the state the middle finger, and that it was not intended for him. Sterling Ivy, the spokesperson for the Department of Corrections, reported to the media that Eileen was woken up at 5:30 a.m. on October the 9th, 2002, and that she had requested a washcloth and towel to freshen up before she was transported to the Rayford Execution Chamber. She told Dawn in letters that she wanted to be executed wearing a black Harley Davidson t-shirt with wings because she believed that she had earned her wings, jeans, a military belt, and a pair of boots with corner toes. Unfortunately, she had to settle for standard prison garb, known as her last rites robe. Many murderabilia collectors have sold small squares of what she was last seen wearing online for approximately $40 a piece, claiming to have received it directly from Dawn. Eileen was reportedly more quiet than usual that morning, which is to be expected, and declined to speak with the chaplain before being taken to the execution chamber, instead kneeling to pray by herself for her victims because she believed that they were possibly too evil to be accepted by God. On October the 9th, 2002, at the Florida State Prison, where Ted Bundy had been executed in the electric chair in 1989, Eileen Wuornos was secured to a steel gurney with leather straps from her chest to her feet, with a white sheet wrapped neatly around her body, and a heart rate monitor attached to her chest. Her arms were swabbed with alcohol, and two intravenous needles were inserted, one in each arm. She had declined the sedative that is commonly offered to inmates before being executed. Some witnesses say that her speech seemed slurred and slow, even without the sedative. It was a somber, overcast, 75 degree Fahrenheit, 24 degrees Celsius, day in Florida, and the prison of approximately 1,200 inmates was on lockdown for the morning. 29 witnesses were present, including 6 victims' relatives, 12 journalists, some Department of Corrections officials, and the state prosecutor, John Tanner. A male officer stood on her left side, while a female officer stood near her head as she was wheeled toward a curtained closet, where an anonymous executioner waited for the warden to signal the go-ahead. When asked if she had any final words, she said, "Yes, I would just like to say I'm sailing with a rock, and I'll be back, like Independence Day with Jesus, June 6th, like the movie, big mothership and all. I'll be back, I'll be back." Wanda Pouncey, the daughter of victim Troy Buress, said, "She's totally off the wall." Terry Griffith, the daughter of victim Charles Humphreys, said, "She seemed surprised to see so many people. I know she appreciated the attention. She was off her rocker." Eileen's final words made little sense to anyone. Sailing with a rock was a reference to Jesus Christ from the Bible, but no one has been able to understand why June 6th was of importance to her. The movie, Independence Day, features a mothership arriving in Earth's orbit on July 2nd. Perhaps in her deteriorated mental state, she had simply misremembered the dates of her reference. When the order was given at 9:32, 3 lethal chemicals were released into her system in succession. The first, sodium thiampental, to render her unconscious within 30 seconds. The second, pancuronium bromide, which paralyzed her muscles and stopped her breathing. And the third, potassium chloride, to induce cardiac arrest. It was reported that she blinked and swallowed hard as soon as the procedure started, and then pinched her eyes closed and attempted to mouth a word. For 17 minutes, witnesses observed her body as her skin became pale, her lips became blue, and the heart rate monitor flatlined. At 9:47 a.m., 2 doctors checked for a pulse and signaled to Assistant Warden Joe Lazenby to pronounce her dead. She was the second woman to ever be executed in Florida and the 10th in the United States since 1976. 36 reporters with 24 cameras and 12 satellite trucks waited for the news of a death on the field across from the prison. with only a tenth of the crowd that Bundy's execution had drawn in 1989. There were 30 death penalty protesters with signs reading, "Time out on executions," and "Execution is not the solution," and a handful of curious onlookers. A true crime enthusiast from Clearwater, Jennifer Santalucia, said, "Truthfully, I love serial killers. There's something wrong with them. They aren't like you and me." She had kept scrapbooks of serial killers and had written to several inmates in prison. This was not a day that she was going to miss witnessing. The crowd watched as her body was loaded into a white hearse and driven out of the prison gates to be cremated. Family members of some of the victims expressed their relief, even though they felt that she should have suffered more. Letha Prata, sister of Troy Bures, said, "I was glad she was gone." At the Last Resort Bar, a small gathering of approximately 24 people had sat drinking coffee, eating Danish pastries, and waiting for her execution to be covered on television. When the news of her death broke, they toasted each other with Bud Light beers. One of the patrons, Dale Westbrook, said, "Well, she picked a beautiful day for it." While there had not been an execution in Florida since January 2001, Jeb Bush had signed off on two executions on consecutive Wednesdays in 1 month, Rigoberto Sanchez Velasco first, and then Eileen Wuornos. He was re-elected as the governor of Florida on November 5, 2002, and became the first Republican governor of Florida to win the re-election to a second term. Dawn had promised her that she would claim her remains and scatter her ashes in their hometown, which she did following her cremation. She buried her ashes at the base of a walnut tree in a yard and played the song Carnival by Natalie Merchant, as requested by Eileen. This song is also featured at the end of Broomfield's 2003 documentary about Eileen, a sad and eerie ending. When Natalie Merchant was asked how she felt about Eileen requesting her song for her funeral, she said that she was surprised and that she could not finish watching the documentary about her because it was so disturbing. Over the years, Dawn has allowed people to come and pay tribute to Eileen at her home, where she sits with them under the tree and plays Eileen's favorite songs. She said, "I suppose she'll be here forever. It's quiet, it's peaceful, nobody attacking her, nobody bothering her. She's very happy. This is exactly where she belongs. No other place but here." Modus operandi. While there have been many serial killers in history before Eileen was even born, it was the difference in modus operandi that defined her as one of the most notorious female serial killers of the 21st century. She targeted strangers, seemed to have a selection criterion for who should die and who should be left unharmed, and said that she robbed her victims for revenge post-mortem. Her victims were all middle-aged white men who were generally traveling in a southbound direction in Florida when she enticed them to pick her up. Captain Bob Kelly from the Volusia County Sheriff's Department said that Eileen had told him that she had a line that no one could cross. "If you crossed that line, and the line changed, if you crossed that line by something that you said or something nasty that you did, you weren't leaving. She could do 8 guys in 1 day and 7 could get away, then one would do something that made her decide, well, he doesn't need to live." Investigators described her as a killer who robs, not a robber who kills, and someone who sat like a spider on the side of the road waiting for her prey. Her life of crime had started early, where she was already trading her body for cigarettes, drugs, booze, and food from the age of 9. By the time she was 15, she had been pregnant, given up her baby at a home for unwed mothers in Detroit, had dropped out of school, had been kicked out of her family home, and was fending for herself on the streets of Troy, Michigan. During this time, she was sleeping in the woods in the dead of winter, sometimes in abandoned cars, other times directly on the cold, frozen ground. She had a friend, Dennis Allen, who also slept in the wild in forts, who she sometimes spent evenings surviving with. Dennis was a cross-dresser, and Eileen was a hitchhiking teenage prostitute, a frightening display of adolescence and the opposite of what either of them needed to properly develop at the time. Eileen eventually found herself accepting rides out of town to increase her earnings with men who would gladly pay to indulge in her youthful body. And by the age of 18, she found herself being arrested in Jefferson County, Colorado, 1,300 miles away, for driving under the influence, disorderly conduct, and firing a .22 caliber rifle from a moving vehicle. Her reckless behavior was escalating, and in her mind, the only solution was to stay on the move. She hitchhiked to Florida because it was warmer and easier to survive on the streets there, but also to conveniently miss her court hearings in Colorado. When she was 20 years old, she met a 69-year-old yacht club president, Louis Gratzfeld, who was desperate to add her to his list of assets, marrying her almost instantly. The marriage was annulled within 9 weeks when, according to Eileen, he revealed his sexual perversions to her, which she refused to participate in. In a fit of rage, she beat him with his own cane, which resulted in him kicking her out of the house and filing a restraining order against her. Her rage had manifested outside of the home in the first few weeks of the marriage as well, where she had been arrested several times for disorderly conduct and assault at the bars that she was frequenting. One must consider how triggering it could have been to be with an elderly man who turned out to be more perverted than she had originally calculated, based on the sadistic abuse that she had suffered at the hands of her grandfather during her childhood. Her brother Keith passed away from esophageal cancer just days before her marriage was officially annulled, leaving her $10,000 in life insurance, which she used to buy a car, pay for outstanding fines, and drive to Florida to put him to rest. She scattered his ashes near Stainhatchee, a small town in Florida's Big Bend region. In letters to her friend Dawn, she said, "I cried my eyes out and dumped his remains along that rocky wall, and then just drove off crying wildly out of my mind, and boy was I ever." Within a few weeks, she had wrecked the car, spent all the money, and was on an escalating path to destruction, unable to deal with the loss of her brother and best friend, the only person that she felt understood her completely at the time. She paused for a moment to think about how she could possibly get her life together and find a more suitable career, and decided to enroll for training to become a police officer. However, when she was informed that she would need to provide the results of a GED exam, a grant from the government, a clear criminal record, and $3,000, she dragged herself back out onto the streets and accepted that she would live a life of street hustling, possibly forever. Slowly but surely, her resentment towards her family, men, and eventually society started to build to the point where she felt compelled to meet her own needs without any regard for anyone else. She became a pure misanthropist. From this moment on, her MO started to take shape, where she became an increasingly troubled and violent figure on the outskirts of normal life. In May of 1981, when she was 25 years old, Eileen was arrested for the armed robbery of a convenience store in Edgewater, Florida, a crime that she committed for 2 packets of cigarettes and $35 in cash. She was sentenced to prison for it and served time from May of 1982 until June of 1983, allegedly attempting to escape several times. In May of 1984, she was arrested for trying to pass forged checks at a bank in Key West, and by January of 1986, she was arrested again, this time in Miami for auto theft, resisting arrest, obstruction of justice, and using a false identity, an alias, her aunt's name, Lori Grody. Police found a .38 caliber revolver with spare ammunition in the stolen car. In June of the same year, a man had filed a report against her at the Volusia County Police Department, detailing how he had picked her up and then found himself facing the barrel of a .22 caliber pistol as she demanded $200 from him. When police searched his car, they found the gun with spare ammunition under the passenger seat, but it seems that nothing further was done about the case at the time. In the same month, 30-year-old Eileen had met 24-year-old Tyria Moore in a gay bar in Daytona and spent the weekend in bed with her, expressing in her letters to her friend Dawn how she fell in love with her almost instantly. Moore quit her job as a motel chambermaid and slipped into the comfort of being taken care of by an extremely determined woman who would do anything to keep her. While Eileen was initially making $150 to $200 a week as a sex worker, Ty encouraged her to expand her client base beyond her regulars, who she had been comfortable servicing for years, and challenged her to bring home $700 to $1,000 per week so that they could afford a nice home together and plenty of nights out on the town. They lived in cheap motels, mobile homes, and sometimes had to resort to sleeping in barns or in the woods to make ends meet. Ty reminded Eileen that she could be taken care of by any other woman if she were to move on, which added unnecessary pressure to Eileen's sex work and started the downward spiral of doing whatever it took to bring home the money to impress her. Their romantic relationship allegedly dissipated, even though the pair remained inseparable for more than 4 years. When Eileen was arrested for assault, driving with a suspended driver's license, or other charges throughout the relationship, Tyria was usually questioned simultaneously because she was generally with her when the incidents happened. In July of 1988, they were accused by their Daytona Beach landlord of vandalizing an apartment that they were renting. They had painted the walls brown and ripped out the carpets without his permission. Following an altercation at a Pasco County supermarket over lottery tickets in November 1988, Wuornos, under a new alias, Susan Blahovec, launched a 6-day harassment campaign of threatening phone calls to the supermarket. By 1989, 33-year-old Eileen had made a habit of supplementing her income from prostitution with theft, which no doubt Ty was aware of. She said that she was mostly drunk while performing her sex acts, while her clients were mostly sober, and that she used alcohol as a tranquilizer to be able to have sex with up to 8 men per day. She told Nick Broomfield in an interview that she was eventually bringing home $200 to $300 per day, $1,200 to $1,800 per week, if she worked a 6-day week as she claimed, and was making money hand over fist to keep Ty happy. She said, "But if I wanted to go out and kill, there would have been hundreds. You see, everyone had taken off for Saudi Arabia, all my regulars, and I had no customers, and I had to get strangers." On November the 30th, 1989, she shot her first victim with a .22 caliber pistol 3 times, where 2 shots impacted his lungs and ultimately caused his death. Eileen was adamant until the day that she died that this murder was committed in self-defense, which seems plausible based on his past and her having been a sex worker for almost 20 years prior. If she had serviced 250,000 men in the past, which was her own exaggerated estimate, what did Mallory do to make her snap, so to speak? Note, she would have had to have sex with 35 men per day for 20 years to realistically achieve this number. According to her testimony, he had brutally raped her after tying her hands to his steering wheel. When she managed to free herself after enduring the pain of rectal and vaginal rape, she wedged her pistol out of her purse and said that she had shot him to prevent being killed herself. His body was found covered with a piece of rug with his pockets turned inside out. If it were not for her confession and detailed testimony, no one would have known what had really happened that night. It took 6 months for her to kill again, and after that, it seemed that she was hooked, murdering one victim after another without any sign of stopping. Jasmine Hurst, a New York-based artist and photographer who had a decade-long correspondence with Eileen and is due to release a film titled A Matter of Life and Death, has a video of Eileen saying, "I said, I'm going to be a bounty hunter for rapists. I'm going to get you, rapist man." Her victims were all aged between 40 and 65 and were mostly found undressed, lying face down, and robbed of their possessions. She told Broomfield, "It was not so much thrill kill. I was in the robbing biz," saying that her goal was to eliminate the witnesses. Some have speculated that Eileen's emotional experience may have been self-defense, but that criminally she was guilty of repeatedly committing first-degree murder. By the end of 1990, she had shot and killed 6 more men after getting them to pick her up and drive her to an isolated location. She sometimes showed people who picked her up a picture of her 2 kids, the that she said she was just dying to get back to if she could just find some way to earn the money. The kids were Laurie Grody's, her stepsister and biological aunt. While some may have expected a wild time, they certainly had no idea that they were going to die. The locations also seemed to have been planned premeditatively, each far enough apart to reduce the suspicion that the crimes were committed by one killer. All victims had mostly been shot in the torso or stomach, except for one, who was shot 4 times in the back of the head. Her weapon was always a .22 caliber pistol, which made it easier for the police to connect the crimes. Some have speculated that her murders were merely opportunistic. However, she repeated the pattern so deliberately that it seems more likely that they were planned out and executed deliberately. In her disturbed state, murder and robbery became a form of certainty for financial survival. It became a desperate form of quick cash when she needed it, especially when she was trying to impress Ty with a better home, more clothes, more cases of beer, and luxuries like the pets they had adopted together. In one way, the abused became the abuser, and the used became the user. In her mind, her actions might have been justified based on the decades that she had allowed men to use her. Perhaps she saw it as a trade-off or a twisted form of self-care where she was going to take what she wanted for once and look after her own needs and desires as well as those of her partner. She likely saw it purely as an act of survival, not acknowledging that she was ultimately robbing others of their survival in the greediest way, something that she constantly blamed society for doing to her. Sue Russell, the author of Lethal Intent, said in an interview, "Eileen was desperate not to be left by Ty. Her fear of abandonment was so profound, her only way of dealing with it was to try to have money. I think that Eileen was driven by her mistaken belief that having money would stop Ty from leaving her. I truly believe that was the driving force behind all these murders." Interestingly, Eileen's murders did seem to match time periods when Ty had, in her perception, emotionally abandoned her. For example, she murdered her first victim after Ty came home with a pretty blonde friend and invited her to celebrate Thanksgiving with them. When Ty's half-sister, Tracy Moore, came to stay with them for the summer of 1990, Eileen murdered David Spears, Charles Carskadden, and Peter Siems. Later, when Ty lost her job and told Eileen that she wanted to move back to Ohio to be with her family, Eileen murdered Charles Humphreys and offered Ty his briefcase as a gift. Her final victim, Walter Antonio, was murdered when Ty decided to return home to spend Thanksgiving with her family, telling Eileen that she needed a break from the relationship. At one point, Eileen had used her money to buy books about survival in the wild because she desperately wanted to isolate Tyria so that she could have her all to herself. Her need to avoid abandonment was the primary driving force behind her actions throughout her life until they had transformed into the grisliest form of a toxic relationship. She would literally do anything for love, including when she was behind bars, where she did whatever she felt God, her adoptive mother, and rookie attorney would want her to do. Before she knew it, she had become a monstrous martyr who would do anything for a crumb of unconditional attachment, which, sadly, she never got a true taste of. John Tanner, the state attorney in her case, said, "She liked to be in control. In fact, these killings, as much as anything, were acts of ultimate control, and we've seen that in serial killer patterns in the past. She killed these men to bring about the ultimate control over their lives, which was to terminate it." While there has always been speculation about Ty's involvement, Eileen insisted that she acted alone, which she most likely did. When Eileen told her about the first murder, Ty told her that she did not want to know the details because she did not ever want to be an accessory to her crimes. The less she knew, the less she could be questioned about it. From there on, it seems that she simply did not ask too many questions about where Eileen was getting all the cash and cars, instead just drifting along with her as her dependent until they broke up. Sadly, it is evident that Ty did not have mutual feelings for Eileen, instead using her for financial gain and an easier way of life, eventually betraying and manipulating her when it counted the most. This cycle of abuse often repeats itself in the lives of the abused, and Eileen was no exception.